Rainbow Valley is a monthly podcast where your host Scott takes a look at key events and personalities that shaped one of the most influential, vibrant, tumultuous and swinging decades in history. Join us as we celebrate the 1960s with the stories surrounding the music and news events of the decade that shook the world. January the 27th, 1967. US astronauts Gus Grissom, Ed White and Roger Chaffee made their way into a brand new spacecraft perched atop a large, powerful Saturn V rocket at Kennedy Space Center in Florida. A routine dress rehearsal, and one of many for their approaching launch into orbit less than a month away. All three astronauts are experienced pilots, all harbouring dreams of one day setting foot on the moon. But little did they know, nor did anyone else, that once they'd entered that spacecraft on that chilly winter's day, they would never leave it alive. The Apollo program would be dangerously close to cancellation before it even got off the ground. The Apollo spacecraft was condemned from the start, comprising of miles of uninsulated wiring, tons of flammable materials confined in an atmosphere that consisted of pure oxygen, and a hatch that wouldn't open. Public opinion was already turning against the space race, and the events of that January evening did nothing to boost their confidence in the programme. It is a story of not only how America continued to fulfil its destiny of placing a man on the moon, but also a valiant tale of three American heroes who lost their lives in a horrific accident. Ladies and gentlemen, Rainbow Valley is proud to present the story of Apollo 1.
I have a dream.
I'm not only a fighter, I'm a poet, I'm a prophet, I'm the resurrector, I'm the savior of the boxing world. If it wasn't for me, the game would be dead.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I think it's all over. It is now. It's four.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Friday, January the 20th, 1961, John F. Kennedy was sworn into office as the 35th President of the United States. The space race was gathering speed, and America was trailing way behind. On April the 12th, cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin completed an orbit of the Earth in his Vostok spacecraft, becoming the first man in space. It was one whole month before American astronaut Alan Shepard piloted Freedom 7 on a suborbital flight, and a further 9 months before John Glenn would become the first American to actually orbit the Earth. The new president was desperate for the United States to take the lead from the Soviets, and so, 8 days after Gagarin's historic flight, Kennedy sent a memo to Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson with questions he wanted him to go over with NASA Administrator James E. Webb and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. Kennedy's principal concern, as laid out in the memo, was did the United States have a chance of beating the Soviets by considering several different options, such as putting a laboratory in space, or by a trip around the moon, or even a rocket to land on the moon, or a rocket to go to the moon and back with a man? Kennedy wanted to know the financial costs of achieving these aims, and more importantly, was the United States working 24 hours a day on existing programs? If not, why not? After questioning military leaders and senior NASA staff, Johnson reported back that with a strong effort, the United States could conceivably beat the Soviets in either sending a man around the moon or landing a man on the moon. In May 1961, Webb and McNamara outlined the future of US space exploration with a series of recommendations. It was well known that one of the main objectives of the Soviet space program was a lunar landing, and with this in mind, it was recommended that all aspects of a US moon landing should proceed at full speed. Not just the orbiting of the Earth, but the research and development of technology that would enable man to set foot on the moon. The memo highlighting these proposals stated, "We recommend proceeding towards this objective. We are uncertain of any Soviet intentions, plans or status. Their plans, whatever they may be, are not more certain of success than ours. Just as we accelerated our ICBM program, we have accelerated and are passing the Soviets in important areas in space technology. If we set our sights on this difficult objective, we may surpass them here as well. Accepting the goals gives us a chance. Finally, even if the Soviets get there first, as they may, and some think that they will, it's better for us to get there second than not at all. In any event, we will have mastered the technology. If we fail to accept this challenge, it may be interpreted as a lack of national vigour and capacity to respond." After spending several weeks considering America's possible options for contending with the Soviets and the race to the moon, Kennedy appeared before a joint session of Congress and made this historic declaration.
"The dramatic achievements in space which occurred in recent weeks should have made clear to us all, as did the Sputnik in 1957, the impact of this adventure on the minds of men everywhere who are attempting to make a determination of which road they should take. Since early in my term, our efforts in space have been under review. With the advice of the Vice President, who is Chairman of the National Space Council, we have examined where we are strong and where we are not, where we may succeed and where we may not. Now it is time to take longer strides, time for a great new American enterprise, time for this nation to take a clearly leading role in space achievement, which in many ways may hold the key to our future on Earth." "I believe we possess all the resources and talents necessary, but the facts of the matter are that we have never made the national decisions or marshaled the national resources required for such leadership. We have never specified long-range goals on an urgent time schedule or managed our resources and our time so as to ensure their fulfillment. I therefore ask the Congress, above and beyond the increases I have earlier requested for space activities, to provide the funds which are needed to meet the following national goals. First, I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. No single space project in this period will be more impressive to mankind or more important for the long-range exploration of space, and none will be so difficult or expensive to accomplish."
At this point, the total amount of time spent in space by an American was a mere 15 minutes. Kennedy would reiterate his intentions in the 1962 State of the Union Address, and more famously, at Rice University on September 12, 1962.
"But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
It was a message that resulted in nearly all of NASA's space efforts being devoted to a lunar landing. For a while, it looked like America may actually pull ahead in the space race. Over the next 5 years, they managed to launch twice as many missions as the Soviets, with the Mercury and Gemini spacecraft steered by the legendary pilots that had the right stuff. And yet, despite this, the Soviets still managed to get in there first every step of the way. The first manned flight. The first woman in space. The first flight with more than one crew member, and the first spacewalk. The only thing that was left was the moon itself, and the only way that America was going to achieve it was with the $24 billion Apollo program. The Apollo program actually began even before the first American had been launched into space. President Kennedy's 1961 speech promising a lunar landing before the end of the decade put a whole new spin on the plans already in place. These plans have been simply to fly astronauts around the moon and return them safely to Earth following the planned Mercury program. In the simplest of terms, the Apollo spacecraft consisted of three main parts. These would be sent hurtling into space on top of the enormous Saturn V or the Saturn 1B rockets. There was the cone-shaped command module. This was where the crew would eat and sleep on the way to and from the moon. There was the service module. This would supply electricity and maneuver power and thrust in order to return home from the lunar orbit. And then the lunar module, a totally self-contained spacecraft in two parts that would use its own rocket system to land on and take off from the surface of the moon. Apollo was a colossal undertaking. At its peak, it employed something in the region of 400,000 workers across 20,000 companies that spanned the entire country. The massive three-stage Saturn V rocket was being developed by Boeing in Seattle and by North American Aviation alongside Douglas Aircraft in Southern California. The Grumman Corporation were responsible for developing and constructing the lunar landing module. This was taking place in Long Island. Cape Canaveral in Florida had been built as the main point of launch for all the Apollo missions. In fact, there were contracts divvied out for just about every aspect of the lunar launch program, from spacesuits and computers to scientific equipment and tractors to transport the rockets to the launch pad. By mid-1963, D. Brainerd Holmes, the head of the Office of Manned Spaceflight at NASA, had been replaced by George Mueller over a falling out with James Webb, NASA's head man. One of Mueller's first tasks was to conduct a survey as to how realistic the deadline was going to be. After all, there was less than 6.5 years left to go now. A long enough period of time, you might think, but the study concluded that NASA's chances of fulfilling Kennedy's promise were only about 1 in 10, and that in reality, the lunar landing itself could not be attempted with acceptable risk until late 1971 at the earliest. It was time to shake things up, not only at NASA, but at all the thousands of companies and organisations involved in the Apollo program. A complete overhaul in the method of testing the separate components was put into place, a system known as all-up testing. Previously, individual spacecraft components had been tested in a somewhat disjointed fashion, with each separate part being rigorously tested before it became part of a larger component. This method harkened back to the early days of the wartime German rocket scientists and the pioneering American flight test engineers. It was a much safer method, but it took up an awful lot of time, and that was something that NASA simply didn't have. And so, in October 1963, just weeks before Kennedy was assassinated, George Mueller ordered the instigation of all-up testing. Under this new system, all equipment manufactured by the outside agencies had to be fully tested and flight-ready before being delivered to NASA. Renowned rocket scientist Wernher von Braun, now director of the Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama, believed that this method would prove to be reckless. But by testing various mechanisms and subsystems at the same time, it would effectively give NASA an advantage of several years that they currently didn't have. NASA had a deadline to keep. Johnson was now president, and the clock was ticking. North American Aviation had been awarded the contract to develop and build the enormous Saturn rocket system. By the time it was also awarded the contract to build the command and service module, its manpower was stretched dangerously thin. 2 years after receiving the contract, North American still didn't have a workable design, despite increasing their workforce to over 4,000 staff. NASA, increasingly troubled by the delays and the issues surrounding the development of the command and the service module, ordered a full-scale investigation in late 1965. The investigation was severely critical of North American and its subcontractors. Subsequently, its relationship with NASA became ever more strained. A full year later, North American did succeed in delivering the first command module, but NASA were becoming increasingly concerned at the standard of the quality control that was involved. They discovered nearly 20,000 errors, failures, and omissions in Command Service Module 012. The environmental control system proved so unreliable, it had to be replaced twice. A press conference was held in December 1966. Joe Shea, the Apollo program manager, openly admitted that while most of the issues could actually be considered as negligible, there were enough serious issues to make him uneasy, and he went so far as to say, "We hope to God there is no safety involved in the things that slip through." Thomas Barron, the quality control inspector at North American itself, viewed Command Module 012, quote, "sloppy and unsafe," while Rocco Patrone, the director of launch operations, went one step further and wrote off the craft as an unacceptable bucket of bolts. North American sacked Thomas Barron for his honesty, and the scheduled launch date of December 1966 was put back to the following February. The pressure was now well and truly on, not only because of Kennedy's promise, but also the rapidly declining popularity of the Johnson administration, brought on by anti-war protests, racial tension, and budget problems. Johnson needed the Apollo program to lift his fortunes, but NASA were also feeling the pressure after having their budget cut by Congress by nearly a fifth. What had been a pursuit for perfection had now been replaced by a sense of acceptance in a product that was, at best, just good enough to do the job. Running in tandem with the development of the command and service module was the production of the flight simulator. As over 600 changes were having to be made to the module, alterations to the simulator soon caused its production to fall behind. This in turn meant that the astronauts found themselves with less opportunity to train for the mission. A mission that was supposed to be an initial exploration flight scheduled to last up to 2 weeks. Astronaut Gus Grissom, one of the original Mercury 7 pilots, personally counted over 100 considerable oversights in the simulator, and in disgust, he hung a lemon over the hatch of the craft. Grissom considered the Apollo 1 flight, still named Apollo 204 at this point, a mission designed mainly not only to check out the spacecraft systems, but also to see if it was flyable and livable. At a press conference in January 1967, Grissom said, "We're in a risky business, and we hope that if anything happens to us, it will not delay the program. The conquest of space is worth the risk of life." The three astronauts selected for this first Apollo mission had a wealth of experience to back them up. Ed White had been the pilot of Gemini 4 in 1965, and during that particular mission, he became the first American astronaut to walk in space. Apollo 1 was to have been Roger Chaffee's first spaceflight, having been selected for the Apollo program following a successful career as a naval officer, aviator, aeronautical engineer, and test pilot. And Gus Grissom, probably the most experienced of the crew, who had become the second American to fly into space as the pilot of the second Project Mercury flight in July 1961, and the command pilot of Gemini 3 in March 1965. In fact, all of the smart money was on Grissom being the commander of the Apollo mission that would eventually be the first to make the lunar landing. Friday, January the 27th, 1967, a two-day test, vitally important for the progress of the future missions, was due to take place. Vitally important, but also at this point in time, almost routine. Control Service Module 12, after weeks of modifications, finally sat atop the huge Saturn 1B rocket at Cape Canaveral. Because of the new testing ruling that had been set in place months before, the original unmanned test had been scrapped in favour of all three astronauts sitting in the cockpit. It was what was known as a plugs-out exercise, meaning that the umbilical cords between the spacecraft and the gantry would be disconnected. There was to be a mock countdown, simulating conditions after a launch. Officially, this test was designated as non-hazardous. There was no fuel in the rocket, and the crew had performed this procedure countless times in the simulator. Because of this, fire crews were placed on standby and not maximum alert, although, as we will soon discover, it would have made little, if any, difference to the outcome on that fateful day. Alarm bells should have rung the day before when backup crew of Shearer, Cunningham and Easel had performed a similar 6-hour countdown test. During a debrief following this particular test, Wally Shearer voiced his concerns to Gus Grissom, saying that there was nothing wrong with the craft that he could put his finger on, but something about it made him feel uncomfortable. In fact, Shearer actually warned Grissom beforehand with the chilling prophetic words, "If you have any problem, even a communication problem, get out of the cabin until they've cleared it up." You're listening to Rainbow Valley, the 60s podcast, telling the stories from the decade that shook the world. Gus Grissom was no stranger to hair-raising space travel that resulted in a situation that would nearly cost him his life. Going back 6 years or so previously, when he was pilot of the Mercury capsule Liberty Bell 7, an almost flawless mission until the very last moment. The flight lasted a total of just over 15 minutes, reaching an altitude of more than 102 nautical miles and flying 262 nautical miles downrange. As the capsule began to enter the atmosphere, the deceleration was ferocious, reaching 11 times the force of gravity. Everything, however, went to plan. The capsule's parachutes deployed without any issues, and he landed in the Atlantic Ocean. A Marine helicopter lifted off from the nearby USS Randolph, as arranged, in order to pick up both Grissom and the capsule. The plan was that the helicopter would hook onto the capsule, raise it out of the water a little so that Grissom could then blow off the hatch, climb out, and be lifted up into the helicopter in a horse collar sling. In order for the helicopter to hook on successfully, one of the helicopter crew would have to snip off a long recovery radio antenna from the cylindrical nose section of the capsule. As the crewman reached down with an extension cutter, there was a loud bang as the hatch of the spacecraft blew off suddenly. Seawater rapidly began to pour over the rim of the hatch, filling the capsule with Grissom still inside. Grissom, who had armed the hatch and removed the restraint on the plunger ready to trigger it, claimed afterwards that he did nothing to initiate the explosion. Grissom, quickly removed his helmet and rolled up the neck dam in order to stop the seawater from filling his spacesuit. However, in the confusion that followed, Grissom was unable to close the oxygen vent on the suit itself. Grissom immediately climbed up, threw himself out of the capsule and started to swim away from the sinking spacecraft, unaware that his suit was filling up with seawater. The helicopter crew, also unaware that Grissom was in danger, believed him to be safe and, following their training, moved in to hook onto Liberty Bell 7. The weight of the seawater in the capsule proved too much for the helicopter, whose engine immediately started to overheat. The crew, having been forced to unhook the capsule, watched in despair as it splashed back into the sea and slipped completely below the waves. Gus Grissom, whose spacesuit was also filling with water, found himself slowly getting lower and lower as he too began to sink. Competing not only with the waves but also the turbulence created by the helicopter rotors, he desperately tried to gain the crew's attention. As the Liberty Bell disappeared, the helicopter crew, spotting the frantic waving arms of Gus Grissom, quickly pulled him to safety. The near miss with the Liberty Bell capsule led to fears that an explosive hatch release could trigger in space with obvious catastrophic results, so this design was omitted on the Mercury and the Apollo spacecraft. The new design on the Gemini capsule enabled the hatch to be opened fairly easily. The hatch, however, on the Apollo spacecraft consisted of three separate components that would take at least 90 seconds to open. The concerns were so great among the backup crew who had just performed that first test that Wally Shearer suggested that Apollo program manager Joe Shea join the crew in the spacecraft to witness the problems himself. Shea did agree to do this, but then there were issues in trying to rig up a communications line for him to use in the capsule. Shea then changed his mind. Shea was adamant that without a means of monitoring communications, it would not be worth him joining the crew. Gus Grissom insisted that how Shea take a look at the whole thing was, in his words, really messy. At this point, Deke Slayton considered getting in the capsule with the crew, but realising he'd probably be better placed keeping an eye on things on the ground, he too decided against it. These two senior NASA officials undoubtedly both made a choice that saved their lives that day, but it was a decision that would haunt them for years to come. And so, on Friday the 27th of January at 1 p.m, the plugs-out test of Command Service Module 012 began. Events would unfold that would prove catastrophic not only for the lives of the three astronauts that perished that day, but also for the USA and its race to the moon. A race that now had every chance of being cancelled forever. It was to be a routine plugs-out test. Classified as a non-high-risk activity, it was a familiar part of the training undergone by the astronauts and the assessment of NASA spacecraft. There would be no fuel in the huge Saturn rocket booster, and in the words of astronaut Frank Borman, it shouldn't have been any more dangerous than taking a bath. Astronauts, fighter pilots, and pilots that eventually become astronauts are a unique breed. And as such, they tend to have an attitude that few others possess. A breed of man where everything they do is a gamble, their lives determined on the roll of a dice, if you will. With astronauts, it isn't just a case of accepting the risks involved, however, it's more admitting that the risks just didn't actually exist in the first place. A couple of days before the plugs-out test was due, Gus Grissom was interviewed by a reporter from CBS. When asked about the dangers involved in this first Apollo flight, he replied, "You sort of have to put that out of your mind. There's always a possibility that you can have a catastrophic failure, of course. This can happen on any flight. It can happen on the last one as well as the first. You just plan as best you can and take care of all these eventualities. And you get a well-trained crew and you fly." Roger Chaffee told the same CBS reporter that he knew there were a lot of unknowns and a lot of problems that could develop or might develop, and they'll have to be solved. And that's what they were there for. This is our business, to find out if this thing will work fine for us. The attitudes and responses expressed by the Apollo 1 crew were consistent with all the Apollo astronauts. But these were in reply to the possibility of an explosion during launch, or perhaps being forever stranded in space. Not a full-scale, fuel-free, plugs-out launch simulation. The test itself was a long, drawn-out, tedious procedure that was scheduled to take several hours. Any issues, problems, or faults detected would only add to the time this would take. A complete plugs-in countdown test had been completed the day before by Wally Shearer and the backup crew, and as we've already discovered, there were 60 major discrepancies identified, particularly with regard to communications issues. With 3 weeks to go before the actual launch had been scheduled to take place, Gus Grissom had serious doubts that the craft would complete a full 14-day mission. And so, at 1:19 p.m, the crew climbed in through the hatch of the Apollo spacecraft. Watching them from the white room, the enclosed area at the top of the rocket, was Deke Slayton. He had driven out to the launch pad with the crew, ridden up to the gantry with them, and remained there until they were all strapped in, something he had never done before. Wally Shearer and the backup crew had flown back to Houston earlier in the day, along with Joe Shea. Slayton was to stay behind at the Cape to monitor the test for the blockhouse. Initially, everything went to plan. Gus Grissom climbed in first and slid himself over to the commander's seat on the left side of the spacecraft. Next, Roger Chaffee, strapping himself into the right-hand seat, and then finally Ed White, as senior pilot, he positioned himself into the centre. But from then on, things just didn't seem to go right at all. Lola Morrow, who had been part of the team assisting the astronauts right through Mercury, Gemini and now Apollo, was listening in on the comms box. She could tell things were not going to plan. Reflecting on the events of the day several years later, she said, "There were too many problems. I kept thinking to myself, Project Apollo? We should call it Project Appalling." The environmental control unit, which had been replaced twice within a matter of months, started to malfunction. Once inside the capsule with the crew hooked into the oxygen system, Gus Grissom started the flow of oxygen and immediately complained that there was a smell of buttermilk, a sour milk kind of odour. Countdown was delayed, the air was tested, but no apparent complications were discovered. The test continued, the hatches closed, and eventually sealed at 2:45 p.m, 1 hour and 25 minutes after the crew first climbed aboard. It then became apparent that the next issue lay within the entire communications system, an issue that dragged on for hours. The communication line between launch control and the spacecraft was so bad that at times the crew could not even be understood due to a combination of dropouts, long pauses, distorted words, and heavy static. As the test approached the 5-hour mark, one of the engineers suggested cancelling for the day. The communications issues were so bad, it probably would have been better just to shut down and start again at a later date. NASA spacecraft test conductor Clarence Chauvin refused, and the test resumed. At 5:40 p.m. the count was held once again due to the communication problems and didn't restart until 6:30. Gus Grissom was getting more and more frustrated. How are we going to get to the moon if we can't even talk between three buildings? They can't hear a thing you're saying, Ed White jokingly replied. Meanwhile, somewhere under Gus Grissom's seat, a frayed piece of wiring was about to spark and start an inferno. There was a minute of silence. Silent except for the static crackle of the communication system. And 5 hours into the test, 4.7 seconds after 6:31 p.m, the wire sparked and ignited a fire. The atmosphere within the capsule was 100% oxygen, a perfect environment to create a blaze that would spread within seconds. Controllers observing the test spotted a power surge in one of the electrical buses that powered the craft, AC Bus 2. There were sounds of movement from within the capsule broadcast over the comlink. The doctors that were observing the astronauts' biomedical data saw a jump in the crew's heart and pulse rates, especially with regard to Gus Grissom. The gauges in the blockhouse being monitored by Deke Slayton and Rocco Patrone went wild. Electrical currents surged like crazy, with readings showing a huge amount of oxygen flowing into the astronauts' spacesuits. The gauges that indicated the cabin temperatures were pushed as high as they could go. Controllers at Houston watched in disbelief as their instruments frantically displayed the same readings, unaware of what was actually happening. All they could do was listen. Deke Slayton turned to a monitor that was displaying images from a camera trained on the hatch window, a monitor which usually showed nothing more than a dark circle. Deke watched in horror as the dark circle lit up and went almost white. Roger Chaffee's voice broke through the static, shouting something that sounded like "Hey!" or even possibly "Flames!" Seconds later, Ed's voice was heard, "Hey, we got a fire in the cockpit," and he began the procedures to unlock the hatch directly above his head. Seconds seemed like long, drawn-out minutes as the crew began their emergency procedures, the only sound being the unbearable hiss of static. Controllers and technicians all held their breath. Eventually, Roger Chaffee's voice punched through the static. "We've had a fire, we're burning up." And then a final blood-chilling, heartbreaking scream of pain. Then silence. Pad leader Donald Babbitt leapt out of his seat, punched the alarm button and screamed, "Get them out of there!" In the launch control room, Chuck Gay, the test director, attempted to contact the crew. "Crew, egress," he said. "Crew, can you egress at this time?" Silence. Gus Grissom, Ed White and Roger Chaffee died in less than 20 seconds. Not necessarily from the fire itself, but from the toxic fumes. The flames had burned through the hoses that fed their spacesuits, so instead of breathing in oxygen, their lungs were filled with toxic smoke. Meanwhile, the heat and the pressure in the capsule, already off the scale, continued to rise. It was estimated at this point that the internal temperature reached a staggering 1200 degrees Fahrenheit. The pressure was so high, the spacecraft burst like a balloon, splitting the hull of the capsule with such force that the launch pad crew in the white room were knocked off their feet by the explosion. Grabbing fire extinguishers and gas masks, technicians desperately tried to put out the raging flames, but were soon stopped by the intense heat and the thick fog that made visibility impossible. Watching helplessly from the blockhouse, Deke Slayton, Rocco Patrone and Stuart Rooser stared in disbelief as a plume of black smoke surged from the top of the launch tower. Then a new horror suddenly dawned on all that were there that day, not only in the blockhouse but also launch control and the launch tower itself. The massive Saturn rocket was directly under the capsule, a capsule that was now ablaze and out of control. Luckily, at this stage of the test program, the Saturn rocket was not fueled. The prospect of what could have happened if it were was beyond belief. There was, however, an escape rocket on the nose of the spacecraft specifically designed to pull the capsule away from the rocket if there was an explosion. That escape rocket was loaded with a solid propellant that potentially had over twice the power of the Mercury Redstone craft that Gus Grissom had piloted 6 years earlier. The pad crew, realizing the danger that could potentially unfold, ran for their lives. Flames were now visible within the two open access panels in the command module near the umbilical link. There was the sound of the cabin relief valve opening and a whoosh of gas as it shot free. Immediately, this gas jet burst into flames like a giant blowtorch. Technicians ran towards the white room but were met by a wall of ferocious flames. Several of the technicians still on the launch tower grabbed masks and fire extinguishers and raced to the gantry and the white room on level 8. Battling the flames, the molten metal and the intense heat, they reached the hatch. Thanks to their fearless efforts and the fact that the fire had actually started to burn itself out, they eventually reached the hatch itself. The handles were so hot they burned through their gloves, and yet they did not give up. Water was hosed onto the hatch to try and cool it down. But it was too late. It took almost 5.5 minutes to get the hatch open. In all, 2 men were hospitalised and 27 had to be treated for smoke inhalation. NASA's lead flight director, Chris Kraft, heard the entire horrific episode unfold in his headset in Houston. Recalling the events of that day, Kraft said, "I heard their screaming voices in the cockpit of the spacecraft. I heard them scream that they were on fire. I heard them scream, 'Get me out of here.' And then there was dead silence on the pad." Fred Kelly, the flight surgeon, was ordered to the white room by Deke Slayton as soon as the fire broke out, but it was obvious to everyone both at Houston and at the Cape what would await him. As soon as the fire was out and the hatch had cooled down enough to be opened, pad leader Donald Babbitt grabbed a flashlight and peered into the burned out shell of the capsule. There, beyond the smoke, were 3 lifeless bodies, all in exactly the position they should have been. Roger Chaffee was in his seat. Gus Grissom was slumped over on top of Ed White, who had been trying to open the hatch. Even as the fire had raged around them, it was clear they had responded exactly as they had been trained, working out the problem by the book. Roger Chaffee had remained in number 3 seat, maintaining communication with the ground crew. Ed White, with help from Gus Grissom, worked together to try and open the hatch. Rocco Patrone, watching from a monitor in the blockhouse, radioed the white room. "Can you do something for the guys?" he asked. No, it's too late. The doctors that arrived at the scene looked into the capsule. They knew immediately that there was no hope. "They're gone," one said solemnly, shaking his head. Following Gus Grissom's near miss 5.5 years earlier in the Mercury capsule, the explosive bolts had triggered the hatch, nearly causing him to drown, there had been a complete overhaul of how the hatch would open on the new Apollo craft. Ironically, if explosive bolts had still been fitted to the Apollo capsule, the crew would have been out in seconds. Instead, a tricky and time-consuming method of releasing the hatch had now been put in place. Safer? Yes. but also fatal. Now, there were three hatches. A heavy inner hatch that opened to the inside of the spacecraft, an outer hatch that opened to outside, and an outer cover that covered the entire capsule, part of the tower safety system. Even in normal circumstances, the entire process of opening the hatches will take a total of several minutes. Ed White in the centre seat would have to insert a ratchet device and loosen the hatch in six different places. He would then have to lower the extremely heavy hatch down to the floor of the capsule, and then following this, he would then move on to opening the outer hatch, whilst at the same time a member of the ground crew would be opening the outer cover. Ed White would have been attempting to complete this time-consuming process in the middle of a raging fire and with far greater pressure inside the spacecraft pressing against the hatch. An impossible task. NASA's immediate priority was to ensure that the wives of the astronauts were informed as soon as possible before the press got hold of the tragic news. A short, indistinct statement was issued, which was purposefully evasive and misleading. It read, "An accidental fire has broken out on the Apollo launch pad, killing at least one person. The space agency says its victim may have been one of the three astronauts scheduled to make the trip." It was now down to Deke Slayton to call the wives of Gus Grissom, Ed White and Roger Chaffee. As well as the wives, NASA officials also had to be informed. Remarkably, NASA Administrator Jim Webb plus several astronauts including Jim Lovell, Neil Armstrong and Gordo Cooper were all at a function at the White House for the signing of the Outer Space Treaty. Following the signing ceremony, most of the upper management at NASA, as well as the heads of several major aeronautical companies, met at the International Club not far from the White House. The meeting had been arranged to discuss the lessons learned from Gemini and the problems facing the Apollo program going forward. Not one person there was aware at that particular time the Apollo program was facing its biggest challenge yet, with the severest of consequences. At 7:30 p.m., President Johnson was handed a piece of paper. He was upstairs at the White House at a retirement party for his Commerce Secretary John Connor. The expression on his face dropped as he read the note, and his heart sank. Turning to everybody present in the room, he said, "I have a sad announcement to make." The gentle chattering in the room fell silent as Johnson continued, "James Webb just reported that the first Apollo crew was under test at Cape Kennedy and a fire broke out in their capsule and all three were killed. He doesn't know whether it was the primary crew or backup crew, but believes it was the primary crew of Grissom, White and Chaffee." Heartbroken, Lyndon Johnson excused himself from the party and made his way back to the Oval Office. The bodies of the three dead astronauts were not removed from the capsule until about 6 or 7 hours after the accident, at about 1 o'clock the following morning. About a mile from the launch pad, the Biomedical Operational Support Unit was situated, and here the decision was taken to set up a temporary morgue. Deputy Administrator Robert Siemens reviewed photographs of the bodies taken both inside the capsule and at the morgue. It was apparent that the fire had been worse on Gus Grissom's side of the spacecraft, having destroyed 70% of his spacesuit. Ed White's spacesuit suffered 25% fire damage and Roger Chaffee's 15%. The autopsy later that morning confirmed that all three had not burned to death, but asphyxiated due to the carbon monoxide flooding through their breathing equipment and directly into their lungs. It was agreed that the burns that they did receive were most likely survivable and almost certainly post-mortem. Betty Grissom, at home that Friday evening, answered the knock at her front door. Wally Shearer's wife Jo stood there crestfallen and said quietly, "There's been an accident at the Cape. I think Gus is dead." Immediately Betty knew in her heart that it was over. She'd faced Gus's death 1,000 times before, not only in the Mercury and Gemini flights but also the combat missions in Korea, every single time. Martha Chaffee was told the devastating news by Alan Bean's wife Sue, along with Jack Swigert's wife Claire. But it wasn't until Michael Collins, future crew member of Apollo 11, came by that she truly believed that the worst had happened. And Pat White, returning home after collecting her daughter Bonnie from their piano lesson, was met on the driveway by Neil Armstrong's wife Jan. Joined later by Peter Conrad and his wife Pat, she probably took the news hardest out of all of the widows, eventually succumbing to cancer and taking her own life in 1982. That evening, President Johnson sent letters to the families of the three astronauts and issued an official statement. "Three valiant young men have given their lives in the nation's service. We mourn this great loss and our hearts go out to the families." Vice President Humphrey knew most of the astronauts very well, having been chairman of the Space Council. In his own tribute, he said, "The deaths of these three brilliant young men, true pioneers and wonderfully brave, is a profound and personal loss to me. I have had such close relationships with them that my sorrow is very deep. My heart goes out to their families and their loved ones." He concluded by saying, "The United States will push ever forward in space, and the memory of these men will be an inspiration to all future spacefarers." President Kennedy's vow to land a man on the moon before the end of the decade had now come with a price. The Soviets issued their statement of sympathy, paying tribute to the three US astronauts, but at the same time stated that they believed that the accident was the result of haste and flaws in the spacecraft's design. Walter Lippmann, writing in Newsweek, criticised what he described as the competitive timetable of the artificially accelerated program. "At the risk of their lives, these men are being sent on a mission for which the scientific preparation is inadequate." Public support for the Apollo program fell significantly over the following weeks and months, many feeling that Kennedy's pledge had come at too high a cost. The US Senate conducted a series of investigations and hearings, concluding that NASA's failure to report its problems with Apollo was an unquestionably serious dereliction. Numerous changes were made to spacecraft in an effort to make the safety of the astronauts paramount. These included replacing the flammable oxygen environment for ground tests with a nitrogen-oxygen mix. Communication between astronauts and the spacecraft designers improved, which all led to a new respect between the two parties. This in turn ensured that any design changes were implemented more effectively with input from the actual people who were going to fly the craft. And perhaps most significantly, the hatch was completely overhauled, ensuring it would open within seconds in any emergency situation. The Apollo program would continue, many would say unnecessarily, and certainly not worth the cost of three lives. It would of course result, however, in the successful Apollo 11 moon landing in July 1969, 5 months before the end of the decade, fulfilling President Kennedy's pledge made back in 1961. January 1966, and Frank Sinatra is headlining at the Copa Room at the Sands Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. Performing twice a day with the legendary Count Basie Orchestra, conducted by Quincy Jones, there is no doubt that Sinatra was at the top of his game. Having turned 50 only a few weeks before, he never sounded better and had the audience in the palm of his hand. Over a period of 7 days, some of those 90-minute concerts were recorded for what was to become surprisingly Sinatra's first commercially available live album and one of the greatest live albums of all time. Ladies and gentlemen, why not join me next time as I present the story of Sinatra at the Sands. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at @RV_podcast or send us your thoughts and feedback to rainbowvalleypod@gmail.com. And don't forget, if you head over to mixcloud.com and search for the Rainbow Valley 60s Chart Show, you can hear our weekly chart rundown of every top 30 from the 1960s as we work our way through from the 1st of January 1960 right through to the end of the decade. My name's Scott. This has been a Stinking Paws production. Thanks for listening.